Well, it's good to be back in school. I always enjoy being on the outside looking in, you know, where school is concerned. How many of you in the 10th grade? We're all the 10th graders. Raise your hand. Will you do that for me? Good. I want you to know the 10th grade is my favorite year in school. Has to be. Three of the best years of my life were spent in the 10th grade. I still have trouble with 10th grade English, you know. Is that where you learn grammar and all that? I really had trouble. In fact, I noticed all you heroes over there with the letter jackets on. I was in an English class when I was in 10th grade, and we had a lot of football players, you know. And one day, we all flunked the English test. Everybody flunked the test. The teacher came in. She was quite indignant. She said, "All right, now, all you dumbbells, stand up." Well, you know, nobody stood up. She said, "All right, now, come on, all you dumbbells, stand up." Well, I stood up. She got real sassy. She says, "Well, we have one little dumbbell today." I said, "Not necessarily, teacher. I just hate to see you standing all by yourself." Oh, man. I always had a lot of trouble with 10th grade English. In fact, I was confused as a termite in a yo-yo, you know. Never knew what was going on. I remember one day, this teacher was just insistent upon teaching me good grammar. And so one day she wrote a sentence on the blackboard. And it said, "I don't have no fun at the beach." She turned to me and she said, "All right, Barry, now how can we correct that?" I said, "Well, get you a boyfriend." That teacher never did like me for some reason. Never could understand that. It hasn't been too long ago that the University of Purdue took a survey of American teenagers, and Professor Rimmers and his staff tried to find out what teenagers are really interested in. And you know that survey of about 20,000 American young people across this nation from the East Coast to the West came up with three or four basic interests of young people. And that's really what I'd like to talk to you about today. Teenagers reveal that you're asking three basic questions about life. One of them is, you want to know how to be liked and to be accepted by your friends. Secondly, teenagers said that they wanted to know when they're in love. And then lastly, teenagers want to know what the future holds. Well, I've been doing some observation across the country. I've talked to many, many young people in assemblies, perhaps 50, 75 assemblies in the last 4 or 5 years. And you know, I've noticed something. If teenagers want to be liked, if they want to be accepted, you do some of the doggonedest things thinking that it will make you liked and accepted. I read a poem not too long ago that goes like this. "I am with the in crowd. I go where the in crowd goes. I am with the in crowd. I know what the in crowd knows. We got our way of walking, we got our way of talking, spending cash and talking trash." Some teenagers think the way to be liked is to talk a certain way. I was in a town in southern state not too long ago, and we went to a regional track meet. The coach was a good friend of mine, a fine Christian man, and he wanted me to go out and see his boys. He had a boy to run a 100-yard dash. He was supposed to go into the state championship finals in track. So we stood just beyond the finish line, and his boy was going to run the 100-yard dash. For some reason, this boy didn't come up to expectations. He was supposed to have won the meet. He had a bad race, and as he ran by us, you know, finishing second, he came walking back by the coach and I, and of course all the other people lined up there and the adults. And this young fella let out a string of oaths as long as your arm and just turned the air green with his cursing. And the coach was very embarrassed by it. So he turned to me and he said, "Mr. Wood," says, "now why did that fellow think he had to talk like that?" And I don't think he really wanted an answer, but I gave him one anyway. I said, "Well, he either talks that way for one of three reasons. First of all, he either curses because he's got the habit so long, he's not even aware that he's doing it. Or secondly, it may be that he's got such a poor vocabulary, he can't think of anything else to say. Or it just may be that he's doing it trying to impress somebody with how mature that he is." Well, you see, young people, I really think the reason he did that was for the third reason. You see, this fella had failed with his athletic ability. He had not achieved in that area, so to bolster his ego, to make himself be liked, to be accepted, he thought he had to curse and talk that way in front of us to sort of gain some of his self-esteem. The reason I think that's the reason is because I've noticed, young people, that you can talk the way you want to talk, and you can turn it off whenever a teacher comes on the scene. If it's a smutty joke going on and there's an adult comes on, the preacher or a parent or somebody of authority, you can just push the halo button, you know, and you can talk the language of the Bible, the language of Zion, just be as good and clean as you want to be. Many young people talk this way with dirty jokes, profanity, and all of this, just trying to impress. But maybe you ought to understand something, that you are what you say. And what you say, young person, is a pretty good indication of what you are on the inside. Many, many years ago, a wise, wise man by the name of Solomon talked about the tongue. And he said, out of the mouth come the very issues of life, out of the heart. And what we are on the inside many times expresses itself in what we say. You know, you can't always fool people all of the time. Did you hear about the little girl who went trick-or-treating on Halloween? Little girl about 4 years old. She was wearing an angel costume. And the little girl had her little halo on and her wings and her white gown. And there was an old fella inside the house, great big fat boy, who had been handing out candy to the kids all night long on trick-or-treat night. Finally, it came down to about 9 o'clock, 9:30, and he only had one big red delicious apple left. Well, he thought to himself, man, I'm hungry. I'd love to eat this apple. So he turned off the porch light, turned off the front light, and was just about to take a bite of that last apple when the doorbell rang. Well, he went up to the door, and he peeped through the shade, and he looked down, and there was that precious, precious little four-year-old angel. And he saw that beautiful little blonde hair and that halo on the wings and there, and he said, boy, it just melted his heart. He said, I've just got to give that sweet little angel this apple. So he opened the door, went in, and the little young lady standing there, she said, trick or treat, mister. Just broke his heart. So he said, all right, young lady, hold out your sack. So she held out a great big brown bag, and the big fat fellow took that big delicious apple, and he dropped it down in that sack. And when it did, it knocked the sack out of her hand and hit down on the concrete. The little angel looked up at him, and she said, you fat fink, you broke my cookies. You know, we're not always what we seem. And a lot of young people think that the way to gain popularity among their friends is to be disrespectful to adults and to authority. I was in school not too long ago handing out towels in a gym class, substituting for a PE teacher, and it was the boys' gym, by the way, girls. And I heard some fellows over by the locker room, and the conversation ran like this. They didn't know I was listening, and I guess I was eavesdropping. But the boy said, hey, George, you going to get the car tonight? You know what George said? No, man. Said, my old man's a fink. He won't let me have the car. I said, well, why not, George? Why won't your old man let you have the car? He said, oh, you know my old man. He's such a fuddy-duddy. He said, I got a traffic ticket the other day. I was only doing 45 in a 25-mile-an-hour zone. And my old man took the keys, and he won't let me have the car. Well, you know, I listened to that conversation, and I said to myself, boy, George and his friend, here are a couple of real honor students, you know. About as close as they ever got to honor was, yes, your honor, no, your honor. But I said to myself, you know, those fellas are not going to make it in life for one basic reason. They have no respect for those who are older or in authority toward them. The wise man Solomon also said this, whosoever curseth his father and mother, his lamp shall be put out. Now, I've never been in a single home of any one of you young people. But let me tell you this. I could spend 1 or 2 days in a classroom as a teacher and observe you. And I can tell you exactly what you think of your parents by the way you react to your teachers, your principal, and your superintendents, and these are in authority over you. Because, young people, your character doesn't change from home to school. The way you will react towards your parents is the same way you'll react toward a teacher, toward a policeman, or toward an employee. You see, many young people think it's smart to sass and be disrespectful to those in authority over you. You think it gains esteem. It makes you liked and accepted. I can remember not too long ago, I was in a classroom, and we had just a genuine old eraser fight. The chalk dust was so thick, it looked like a drag strip at Santa Anita, you know. And the teacher came in, saw all the chalk dust, and she was quite upset. She said, all right, now, order, order. Some wise guy at the back of the room said, Coca-Cola! Well, the teacher went back to this guy. He was always popping off, you know. She grabbed a hold of him, and she said, Jameson, I think the devil's got a hold of you. And she began to shake James like that. Said, I think the devil's got a hold of you. And James says, I think he has too. I was walking down the hall toward a high school assembly not too long ago. The principal and I rounded the corner, and the principal was telling me all the problems he had in his school, you know. And he put his arm around me very affectionately. He said, now, Mr. Woods, said, just what would you do if you were in my shoes? I looked down and said, well, I think I'd polish them. But as we rounded the corner, there was a boy kissing a girl in the hallway. Boy, the principal got red in the face. He said, excuse me just a minute, Mr. Wood. So he went over to this boy and grabbed a hold of him and said, son, I'll teach you to kiss a girl in the hall. And the boy said, oh, no, you won't, bub. I already learned. Well, I guess that sounds cute, and you laugh really to keep from crying. But you know, the truth of the matter is, that attitude, young people, may get you some temporary attention, but it will not make you popular. it certainly will not get you by in life. Because you see, it takes character to succeed in life. It doesn't make any difference how much talent you've got, how much native ability or IQ you might have. If you do not have the ability to respect those in authority over you, it will show up on a job one day when you try to be an employee. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. You boys who are active in football. There's a young man who came out of this city a few years ago, an all-state football player. He went to play ball at one of the outstanding schools in this part of the country. He played for Bud Wilkinson at Oklahoma University. He was probably the greatest halfback that school had ever seen. Everybody's All-American in high school would have been everybody's All-American in football. But this young man got kicked off the team his junior year for drunkenness, for rowdiness, for being disrespectful to the coaches and staff. He lost his scholarship. He went ahead to get a football contract with what was then with the Baltimore Colts. He stayed with the Colts a half a season. But one night he got drunk, kicked in a door, had a lawsuit against him. He went from one football team to another. He's now been on five NFL teams, and he doesn't make the starting lineup more than a week or two on any ball team. Do you know why? He has never learned to follow instructions. He's never learned that it takes character to get by in this world. I guess he does it to be liked, but in reality, it only gets him attention. And then some young people think that the way to be liked and be accepted is not necessarily the way you dress, or how rough you talk, or how disrespectful you are. They think the way to be liked and to be accepted perhaps is in proving your manhood by how much booze you can inhale. I was teaching a health and hygiene class in a high school not too long ago, and I had 70 high school boys in a health and hygiene class. Now, teachers, that's misery, any way you look at it. And I was trying to teach these fellows. We came to the section in the book where we talk about the evils of alcoholic consumption. So to give an illustration, I wanted to illustrate just how harmful it could be. So I brought a box of fishing worms, a glass of water, and a glass of alcohol, and I set it up upon the table. I said, now, fellas, I want to show you something. So I took the worm out of the box of worms, out of the good Mother Earth, and I said, now, I'm going to put this worm in a glass of water and watch how it lives in that environment. So I put it in the glass of water, and that worm just swam around just having a ball. I said, now, watch this. And I took the worm out of the glass of water, and I put it in the glass of alcohol, and boy, it just shriveled up. And I said, now, fellas, what's the moral of that object lesson? One wise guy raised his hand and said, I know, teacher, if you drink, you won't get worms. You know, boy, some people, you just can't get the message over, can you? But you know, there are just a lot of guys and gals today who come to age 16, 17, 18, and they think the way to be liked and to be accepted, to be popular, is to hit the booze trail on the weekend after the ball game. I think the way to do it is to show how much stuff you can hold. I played baseball in Oklahoma with a young man who signed a contract with what was then the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1957. This boy and I had played baseball together ever since the fourth grade, all through high school. He was a shortstop. I was a second baseman. They said we were the best keystone combination in Oklahoma City during that period that we were together. He signed a baseball contract when he graduated. But let me tell you about my friend Joe. Joe was only 5'9" tall. He weighed 135 pounds, soaking wet. Had tremendous wrist. He could throw a baseball with those skinny bone arms of his as hard as anybody I've ever known. And he could hit a baseball, too. An outstanding young athlete, fast as grease lightning. We called him Comet most of the time. That young man, when he became a senior, it seemed like Joe always had a chip on his shoulder because he always had to prove that he was as big as anybody else. Now, he was big in talent with a baseball in his hand, and he was big in many ways, but he had to be big physically as well. And so Joe began to drink when he was about a junior in high school, and every time he went out with the boys, he always had to drink more than anybody else. Because, you see, Joe somehow seemed to think that you could find courage in the bottom of a bottle. And when he got a few drinks, he began to bolster his ego, and he became a little Napoleon, you know, and he could lick the world. He got a bonus from the Brooklyn Dodgers after he graduated from high school for $10,000, which was a lot of money in those days. He bought himself a fire engine red Chevrolet convertible, and he was the cat's meow around our school before he left to play ball. He went away to play baseball in Virginia, but it was an interesting thing about Joe. He had always been the big shot on the team. But when he went with a bunch of professionals, he had a sore arm. He began to not hit the ball as they thought he should on a Class A ball team. And for the first time, he was benched. And then the team made a road trip, and Joe got left behind. It was the first time in his life it had ever happened to him. And so to prove that he was still just as big as anybody else, he and a couple other ball players who hadn't made the road trip got in his convertible. They and their wives went to a drive-in movie. On the way home, the girls got in one car. Joe was in his convertible with the other two ball players. They drank all the way through the drive-in. And then as they left to go, they said that he threw real estate all over the county as he dug out to get out on the highway, substituting manpower for horsepower, you know. That happens sometimes. He went around a curve in West Virginia. They said he was going over 90 miles an hour. The rear end went out from under the car on wet pavement, threw Joel out, and the first time the car landed, it landed on top of my young friend. His wife was in the car behind, and when she drove around the curve, there lay her husband, 18 and a half years old, with his throat cut from ear to ear. Now, young fellas, I carried Joel Parkey to the grave. I was a pallbearer at his funeral, and I buried him, I lowered him in the ground, and picked up a handful of earth and threw it upon his coffin. Now, it seems to me he paid too high a price just to be liked or to be accepted. And the point is, it really didn't make him popular in the first place. Let me show you something, young people. If American young people want to be liked and to be accepted, here's the lesson that Barry Wood would give you today. Learn this lesson and it could change your life. There is a great deal of difference between getting attention and being liked. Now you see, I could have gotten attention today in this assembly if I'd have come out behind this curtain with nothing but my undershorts on. Now, I would have gotten a lot of attention, brother. In fact, they'd have called a paddy wagon and hauled me off to the insane asylum. But it sure wouldn't have made me popular. Not with the principal, not with you, not with anybody. You see, you can do a lot of things like smoke and drink and curse and swear, be disrespectful to policemen, to teachers, to parents, and it will get you attention. But it certainly will not make you popular. You see, there's a difference between getting attention and being popular. Popularity is based upon achievement. And because I achieve something, I am therefore respected. And then because I am respected, I become popular. You see, you achieve something with your life, it will gain you the respect and esteem of your friends, and then you will be popular. Now, secondly, teenagers want to know when they're in love. Now, if ever there's anything I ought to be an authority upon, it ought to be love. However, where sex is concerned and love, I started off as a very shy young person. In fact, when I was a little boy, I was so shy about sex, my mother tells me that when I was a little bitty boy and I'd take a bath, that I always made her blindfold my rubber duck. I was so embarrassed. In fact, I was so shy as a kid, I wouldn't even dress in front of a prince's phone, you know. But I've noticed this. We all seem to become interested in sex a lot younger nowadays than we did a few years ago. In fact, I can remember when I was in kindergarten, I had a crush on the very first teacher that I had. She was a beautiful redhead, 62 years old. But boy, I had a crush on this teacher, and everybody was bringing the teacher an apple, you know, so I thought I'd be different, and I'd bring her a flower. So I brought her a flower, and I thought I'd write a little poem with it, show how much I thought of her. And here's the poem that I wrote in kindergarten. This little flower will fade and die, but you, dear teacher, will smell forever. Oh, me. And in the first grade, you remember in the first grade when you begin to make your own valentines? You know, you put Hallmark out of business, all the cards are handmade, and you write your own poems. I always had trouble with poetry. I can remember the first poem I wrote to my first grade sweetheart, you know. I wrote it on the valentine, and it went like this. Roses are red, violets are blue. Your mother was pretty. What happened to you? And then I tried this one out. And fellas, you might put this on your valentine this year. It goes like this. I pressed a kiss to her lips. What could I do but linger? And as I ran my fingers through her hair, a cootie bit my finger. And here's one. Here's one a little boy in the third grade wrote. He goes like this. It was love at first sight. It could do no harm. She broke my heart, so I broke her arm. Oh, man. I can remember the first time I got up the nerve to kiss a girl. You know, this is a very trying time, you know, when you're trying to get up the nerve the very first time. Sex is new and all of these experiences are new. I was in about the 7th or 8th grade, I guess, and I was with this girl and I was trying to get up the nerve. Oh, I was in the 6th grade. I started young. And we were sitting out on the curb, you know, one hot August afternoon, passing the time of day, barefoot, flipping rocks with our big toe, you know. And I turned to this girl and I said, can I kiss you? She didn't say anything. I said, may I kiss you? She still didn't say anything. So I said, are you deaf? And she said, are you paralyzed? Well, they're not always as shy as you think they are. But I remember that very first kiss. There's a girl there that can remember the first kiss too, yeah. I remember that very first kiss. Fellas, here I was in the 6th grade, and that very first kiss just sent cold chills down my back. Her popsicle was dripping down my neck. Oh, man. I had some interesting girlfriends. I never did have very good choice where girlfriends were concerned. In fact, I had a lot of trouble with, you know, identifying sex and what have you. In fact, I can remember when I was a kid, my first dog was named Ben. Then when Ben had pups, I had to rename him Ben-Hur. But I had some interesting girlfriends. Let me tell you about some of my girlfriends. The first girlfriend I had in junior high was really skinny. In fact, this girl was so skinny that when she'd get a runner in her hose, she fell out. In fact, this girl was so skinny. She was so skinny when she was a little girl. They said that when she was a little girl, she was so skinny that her mother had to put a bookmark in her bed to keep her from getting lost between the sheets. She was so skinny, she only had one stripe on her pajamas, you know. Oh, me. And then I dated another girl. I had one girlfriend that was so bow-legged that when she sat around the house, she really sat around the house. And then, fellas, I dated one girl who had one green eye and one red eye. And I never did know whether to stop or go, stop or go. Oh, me. And then I dated one girl, seriously. I dated one girl who was so ugly. In fact, well, she wasn't pretty, and she wasn't ugly. Truth is, she was pretty ugly. But this girl was so ugly, she had a wart right on the end of her nose. But you know, I got to where that wart didn't bother me because her lower lip covered it. And I dated one girl who had the most beautiful, long, black hair you've ever seen. Of course, it was all under her arms. And then I dated one girl. She was so fat. Her name was Bertha, by the way. And I lived down in southeastern Oklahoma, and they had a nickname for our county. It was back in the hills, and the nickname for our county was Booger County. Well, fellas, not that kind of booger. You know, a booger is a varmint like a bobcat or a coyote or a wolf or something. And we had a lot of varmints in our hills, and they called it Booger County. Well, old Bertha was so fat, all the boys in our school called her Big Booger Bertha. And one day, Bertha was walking across the street from our school. She wasn't looking where she was going, and a Volkswagen hit her. And it just tore the Volkswagen all to pieces. The guy got out of the car, and he was mad. Bertha was mad, and Bertha said to him, well, why didn't you watch where you were going? And I said, why didn't you go around me? And the fella said, well, I didn't think I had enough gas. But you know, young people want to know when they're in love. I heard a poem the other day on television that kind of says what a lot of people think love is. The poem went like this. There was a little girl who had a little curl right in the middle of her forehead. And when she was good, she was very, very good. And when she was bad, she was very popular. Now that's funny, but you're afraid to laugh. You know why? Many, many young people think that to find out what love is, you must find out what sex is first. And many, many young people today are just like that little girl with the curl. They think that to become popular, you must have some experience in dating and with sex. Now, if I can say anything helpful to you right now, I think it would be good if you just fasten your attention upon me. You know, most of the time when somebody begins to talk about sex and dating, it turns out to be a pep talk to the girls. Have you ever noticed this, young women? And so they say something like this. Well, she's right. They quote something like this: the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. Or they quote Abraham Lincoln: I owe all that I am or hope to be to my mother. And it turns out basically to be a pep talk to the girls, and nothing's very said very much to the boys. Well, young men, I want to share something with you and with the young ladies. If you want to know when you're in love and what love is, let me tell you something. I've noticed this. In every high school I've ever been in, every one of you can think of a couple, of a guy and a gal. You can think even of a young lady who began to date in high school. She got married right after high school. After a year, a baby is born. Then there's a divorce, and the fellow joins the army, or he leaves, and there's a girl living somewhere in an apartment by herself, trying to take care of her baby at age 18 or 19. It happens all over the country. Red Book Magazine says that of all the teenage marriages in America today, that one out of five American teenage marriages, the girl will be pregnant on her wedding day. And you know, we're always hearing it said that little Janie so-and-so or little Susie so-and-so, she got in trouble. But you never hear anything about a boy getting in trouble. Now, not because it's not biologically possible. It's because we sociologically do not hold a boy responsible where sex is concerned. I was in a high school not too long ago. And after the assembly, a young man came up to me and he asked if he could talk to me. We went to the principal's office. Now, that's the only conditions under which I'll go to the principal's office. It's just a little principle of mine, but I don't spend much time in the principal's office. It goes back to the days when I was in high school, you know. In fact, I spent so much time in the principal's office that they had a razor strap hanging on the wall, and the principal put a motto under it, due to me: I need thee every hour. But this young man and I went to sit down and talk, and here's what he said. He said, Mr. Woods, and I'm going to graduate this May. He said, I've got a scholarship to play football at Texas Tech. He said, but I'm going to lose my scholarship. And I said, why? He said, well, you see, to get that scholarship, I have to have a recommendation from my principal, from my pastor, and from one other adult as to my character. And I'm afraid I won't get that scholarship or that recommendation. And I said, well, why? Well, he was a bit embarrassed and awkward. And finally, here's what he said. Now, this young man was an honor student in his school. All-state football player. Outstanding student. President of the student council. And he said, well, I've been dating a girl in school. And said, I guess things have kind of gotten out of hand. We've been dating pretty thick, courting pretty heavily. He said, well, I just found out the other day that she's expecting a child. And he said, you know, it's going to ruin my whole life. It's going to wreck my future. He said, I wish I could just forget the whole thing. I wish the thing had never happened. I wish I could forget about it. I wish I could just do away with the whole mess. Well, you know, I had a lot of respect for that young man until he said that. Because, you see, I asked him a question. I said, young man, what makes you think you have the right to quit? What makes you think you can just turn off your emotions? Turn off your responsibilities. You know, one of the great problems with young people today is you've got the I quit routine. If things don't go your way, I just quit. I'll just drop out of school, or I'll just drop out of my responsibilities where life is concerned. So I opened a Bible, and I turned to the 20th chapter of the book of Exodus, and I moved my finger down to the 7th commandment. I said, young man, read that to me. And he read it. Thou shalt not commit adultery. I said, oh, no, that must be wrong. Let me read it. And I read it. Thou shalt not commit adultery, girls. I said, now you read it. And he read it again. And he said, well, I know, Mr. Wood, the word girls isn't there. And I said, you're right. It isn't. I said, young man, God does not condemn in young ladies what he condones in young men. What is right for one is right for the other. What is wrong for one is wrong for the other. Young people, if you could follow me around the country and look at some of the miserable, wrecked lives of the young people that I talk to, you'd listen to me about what love is and what love is all about. If you want to know when you're in love, you learn a basic lesson right now. That love and sex are not synonymous. They do not mean the same thing. 2 out of 3 marriages end in divorce in America every year. You know why? Because many of those marriages, the vast majority of them, got started in the back seat of a parked car. And that's why they don't last, because young people, and I do not say this to be funny, you don't base a marriage and you don't base love in the bedroom. It's based in the living room. You see, love has a whole lot to do with the kind of person you are. It has the idea of giving, of sharing. It has the best in mind for the partner with whom you're involved. And yet a lot of young people think that even to be popular, you must become some kind of a Don Juan Romeo where date is concerned. But I tell you this today, that the cheapest, shoddiest road to popularity is the shameful, disgraceful use of your body where sex is concerned. It will not make you popular. It will make you ashamed. It will make you cheap. And then thirdly, young people want to know what the future holds. And I'll close with this. You want to be a success in life. Every one of you do. You don't want to waste your life. You're coming to the time where you're trying to say, what am I going to do with my future? Well, if you want to know what the future holds and you want to know how to make a living, let me ask you this. Do you think it's possible to make a living without knowing how to live? Many young people think that to be a success means you've got to make a living. And to make a living, you've got to make a lot of money, and automatically you'll be successful. There is a millionaire right here in Fort Worth, Texas, who is a very dear friend of mine. And that man has made something like $2.5 million, and he's made most of it in the last 15 years. He and I were deer hunting not too long ago on a deer lease. And you know what he said to me? He said, Barry, I have wealth, I have security, I have everything that I thought I wanted, and yet my life is empty, my life is miserable. You know what his problem was? He had learned how to make a living, but he never learned how to live. And young people, if you want to know what your future is going to hold, you better find out who holds your future. And you see, I know how to live, so I don't have to worry so much about making a living. I found out how to live when I was 16 years old, when somebody opened the Word of God to me and told me that Jesus is the one who gives us life. He said, I am come that you might have life and have it abundantly. Oh, I know immediately when I bring up the Bible and I bring up the name of Jesus that some of you begin to say to yourself, oh boy, here comes a commercial. That's what I've been waiting on. And a lot of young people think it's sissified to talk about the Bible and to talk about God. But young people, I don't apologize for the Bible and I don't apologize for God. Do you know why? Because when I did apologize for Him as a teenager, I was miserable inside. And the problem with a lot of you guys and gals is that you're more afraid of what the crowd thinks than you are about what God thinks. That's why most of you know how to play, but you don't know how to pray. You know the top 10 tunes, but you couldn't name the 10 commandments. You can go to a ball game, shout like old Billy Ned, and then you go to church and sit like old Billy's dead. You can go to a ball game, shout like a Comanche Indian, come to church, and sit like a wooden Indian. You know why? You're afraid to let anybody know that you can get excited about living the way the Bible says you ought to live. Because we're afraid somebody will call us a fanatic. Isn't that interesting? I can go to one of your ball games, get excited about it, and you'll call me a fan. But if I begin to get excited about God, you call me a fanatic. Well, let me tell you something, young people. I've tried all the things I've talked to you about today, to be liked and to be accepted. I've tried to struggle to find out what true love is, and sex became a hang-up for me like it was for you and like it is for you as a teenager. But I've learned this. When I found out how to live, I found out that all of these other things fall in place. I gave my life, my heart, my all to God's way of life in the Bible through Jesus Christ. It changed my life. That was 15 years ago, and I haven't gotten over it since. So I say to you, if you want to be liked and accepted, you want to know what the future holds, you want to know when you're in love, then you put your life where God can put His claim upon it, and you'll find the answer to all these basic questions of life. I was speaking at a PTA not too long ago, and I had given a lecture to the adults, and one lady had brought a 10-year-old son, 11-year-old, somewhere along in there, and she came up to me, she was all excited about the message that I'd shared, and she said, oh, Mr. Wood, said, I'm just so filled with your message. I said, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. She said, oh, I am. Said, I'm just filled to the brim. And then she turned to her little son and said, son, weren't you just filled with Mr. Wood's message too? The kid looked up at me and he said, yeah, I had a belly full too. Well, I guess some of you maybe have had a belly full of me today. But I hope that somehow your life can be a little better because we spent time together today. This has been a wonderful day. It's a wonderful school. It's a wonderful assembly. Wonderful teachers. This is a recording. I want to thank you for letting me be here today, for all of you who are so patient to listen. And I wish you God's best wherever you go and whatever you do. Thank you so much.